Welcome to Power Play. On the day a Nova Scotia civil rights hero became the first woman other than the Queen to grace a Canadian banknote, Viola Desmond's face will replace Sir John A. Macdonald on the $10 bill, and about time, too. All right, coming up on today's show, an odd visit by the outgoing U.S. Vice President starts today to kickstart an important gathering of premiers and Indigenous leaders with the Prime Minister. We'll ask a premier to set up expectations for the First Minister's Conference on climate change. And after years of stalling, Canada's old-age search and rescue aircraft are being replaced by a modern fleet from the Airbus Consortium. The Defence Minister tells us what these planes can do and why it took so long to get this deal off the ground. And a former U.S. ambassador to Canada swings by to decipher President-elect Donald Trump's curious transition so far. A climate change skeptic was appointed to the Environmental Protection File yesterday. We'll ask him what that means for a carbon-taxed Canada. But first, the search began for new search and rescue aircraft 14 years ago when Jean Chrétien was prime minister. Today, finally, a winning bid was announced. The Minister of National Defense delivered the news. Harjit Sajjan joins me in the studio. Welcome, Minister. Great. Nice to have you with us. Thank you. All right, I'm always curious about these planes. Like the old ones were pre-internet era. Planes, what can these things do? What can they find and how can they find it?
Well, it's not the airplane itself. It's first of all, it's the people that use it. And our SAR techs, our pilots are phenomenal at what they do. Mm-hmm. They're the best capability. By giving them this extra tool to be able to do their job, it can, the excitement in their eyes to be able to get this is extremely important. And these planes have some phenomenal radar systems that is, you're not just relying on the eyeball anymore. You're using technology. It allows you to be able to identify targets on the ground, up to 100 targets that you can track. It can link in with search and rescue technicians on the ground. It can link in with other command and control centers as well. That allows for much search parameters and basically allows the troops to be able to do their job a lot better.
You called it a game changer.
Yes.
How is it going to change the game of finding people and presumably rescuing them as well?
Well, first of all, is with the new technology that's on the aircraft.
That's it, right? You can find a person in the middle of the ocean.
Well, you know, but the thing is, what they do and how they integrate the technology is also extremely important. It allows them to find, and then at the end of the day, it's still the SAR techs that have to do their business to be able to do that rescue. But that time to find somebody is just so important, and within that time, it can mean life or death. So with the new the radar, the infrared, it can fly in inclement weather. It can identify somebody on the ground. I can't remember all the exact ranges that they showed me. I think it was on the ground, I could identify a human up to 8 nautical miles, right?
Wow.
And so it just allows our folks to be able to do their job a lot better and give Canadians the confidence that we have the ability to come out and rescue them at the time of need.
So how many we've got? Is
2016 that will be coming, and by 2019, the first one will be arriving.
Yeah, okay, 2019. And is there a lot of economic impact for Canadian manufacturers in this procurement?
Absolutely. Any procurement that we do, there has to be economic impact for Canada. That's that value proposition that Minister Isett always works on. And so this, too, will bring impact for Canada.
Okay, so is there lessons here for how we can do the procurement, how to avoid these problems in the procurement for our jet fighters? This has been a long process. I don't know why it took this long. Seems like a no-brainer, but here we are. Took 14 years to land these. Is there a way to use this lesson to make sure the jet fighters are faster?
Well, not just lesson from this. Even previous other procurement files that have taken a very long time. When Minister Foote and I received our portfolios, we worked very collaboratively together with our officials on how we can become more efficient. Mm-hmm. And so, like a simple things, we do joint briefings together. So instead of waiting one file from one department to the next, those are things that we can manage. And our officials have also done a considerable work to move things along. And so our goal is to make the procurement process more efficient, not just for this file. And we demonstrated this here. We're going to do it for the shipbuilding strategy as well, and especially for our fighters.
And what happens with the Buffaloes and Mercs? They're ready to be retired, right?
Yes. I mean, those have been flying for
really, it's 1960.
60 years now they've been flying, right? But the thing is that they did great work, and it just shows the ingenuity of our Canadian Armed Forces members to keep them flying. But we should never have to put them into that position. This should have been done a long time ago, 2004 when this was started. And I'm glad to be able to announce this today. But there'll be a disposal plan in place, and so decisions will be made on that afterwards.
Have you been able to do a post-mortem and found out why this bid didn't get let 5-10 years ago? I mean, what was holding it up?
Well, I've looked into it, and I try not to, I've always said, try to take anything for our military into a partisan role. So I've looked at the previous years on what the challenges were with the file that delayed this and having to start over in many cases. So what this allowed us to do is look at how we're going to move things forward. So when you do a proper process on making sure that the state of requirements are done fairly, and you allow the process to take its course, and then a decision is made at the end of it, and that's what we have today.
All right, I got to ask you, peacekeeping. We've been talking about peacekeeping missions being announced for a long time. Where are we on announcing this? Is it getting close?
It is getting close, yes. I know, you know, Canadians want to know, and I know especially yourself and the media does want to know, but we want to make sure that we go through the right process for all of us as government as well, so that we can, whatever plan that we that when we announce is going to have the impact. So we've done a considerable amount of work, and re-entering into peace operations, we have to be able to, what new things are we going to be able to do? And we've got a tremendous amount of experience to bring to the table. Mm-hmm. So General Vance and his team has done a lot of work as officials from the other departments as well. And I'm very happy with it, but and I look forward to
end
having
the
discussion.
End of the year, before the end of this year?
Year's not over yet.
Is your aim's to get it over this year, right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, we'll stay tuned. Keep an eye on that. Thank you, Minister. Appreciate you coming
in. Thanks for having me.
All right. If anyone's seen the Premier of New Brunswick wandering around out there, tell him to get over to Power Play, because we're going to get a preview of the first meetings with him. And we will look at a Canadian carbon tax, because it's becoming problematic with the U.S. poised to embrace exploration over environmentalism. After the break, we'll have advice from Down Under on why we should kill the tax before it's imposed. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, the premiers and their entourages are now arriving for tomorrow's first minister's conference on environmental protection and healthcare funding. We have found him. Let's set up tomorrow's meeting with New Brunswick Premier Brian Gallant. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Lost in the snow, I guess. All right. It sounds to me as though a lot of the heavy lifting is over, and that tomorrow is more or less confirming what negotiations have already happening. Is that correct, or is there a lot of work to be done?
Well, hopefully that's the case. I mean, we as a country have to step up to combat climate change. I think all the premiers and, of course, the prime minister recognizes that. I think we all, in our own way, have been doing what we can in our provinces, territories, and as the federal government, they've been doing what they can to ensure that we're doing this in a way that we're going to still have economic growth and we're still going to have good-paying jobs for the middle class and for Canadians. We believe that we're going to have a deal tomorrow, but, I mean, this is a complex issue. There's lots to consider. There's lots of realities that are different around the country. Our opportunities and challenges are different. So certainly I'm optimistic that we're going to leave tomorrow with a strong framework in which we're all going to work towards ensuring that we're combating climate change in a way we're still growing the economy.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's still an important discussion, and we'll see how it goes tomorrow.
Framework always sounds like a rough guideline to me. It doesn't sound like much of a commitment. I mean, how ironclad are the plans to actually meet these targets going to be?
I understand. I mean, when Canadians hear something like framework, task force, all these words sort of at sometimes ring hollow. I get that, but yeah. Words matter. And I can tell you that the declaration that we all signed in Vancouver, it mattered. I can tell you that the declaration we signed as an example as a province with New England states and eastern premiers to ensure that we're doing everything we can as a region to work together to combat climate change, it matters. It played a significant role in setting up our targets as a province to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. Although it may sound a bit hollow, I can tell you that this is some very important and significant work that's being done and hopefully will be completed tomorrow.
Do you worry that Canada is going to be so completely out of step with what's going on in the United States that we're going to be, some people say uncompetitive, but certainly that we will pay a price for being green while the other side of the border is doing anything but?
I think it's really important for us to remind ourselves we're doing this as a country because it's the right thing to do.
Right.
I mean, we want to leave the country and the world in a better place for the next generation and the generations after that. So that's the reason we're doing this. Now, of course, what economic impact it could have is very important, and we have to figure that out and do it the right way to make sure there's economic growth. So I think it's important for us to calculate a few other things. If the U.S. don't step up as much as they maybe were intending to before because of the recent election and maybe change in policy, we should remind ourselves that at one point they may want to come back to the table, and they may lose 4 years, maybe 8 years. During that time, as a country, we can advance innovation, we can advance the clean tech sector in this country, we can advance all the great ways in which to combat climate change while creating economic growth, and then you'd have a big country like the U.S. looking for those innovations. So really, it could actually put us at the forefront when it comes to the green economy and clean tech, and it's important for us to recognize that. And one other consideration that's very important is, and I've learned this in my short time as premier, and it's even more important than I've ever thought it was, when you go to other countries and you want to do business with them, the brand of the country matters. And if we don't step up on combating climate change, that will have an impact on trade. It will have an impact on our ability to sell our products and services to other countries. So I think it's important for us to calculate that in some shape or form.
But something that's at the top of the polls is healthcare. And you met with the federal health minister today, Jane Philpott, but it's part of the dinner discussions tomorrow. What do you hope comes out of that? Do you think the proposed health accord has to be bumped because they're talking 3% and you're used to 6% increases every year?
There's lots to say on this. So I think the first thing is I want to be fair to the Prime Minister and the federal government. I mean, there are talks that are going on. We have this meeting. It's an important meeting tomorrow to ensure that we're all coordinating our efforts as a country to combat climate change in a way that we stimulate the economy. Very important conversation to have. Of course, healthcare is so important. It's one of the most important, if not the most important program that governments can offer its people. So, of course, we want to discuss that. And I very much appreciate the fact the Prime Minister is going to make some time for us to have a good discussion on what we can do to advance the healthcare negotiations. I don't think over dinner we're going to have a deal. There's really no chance of that, in my opinion. I think that's normal and to be expected. But hopefully we'll have a chance to give some of our ideas, some of our suggestions and concerns, and that will influence the negotiations moving forward. Mm-hmm. For me, what's important, New Brunswick has an aging population.
Right.
It's by far our most significant challenge, has a stress on our workforce. It adds fiscal pressures to our healthcare system and to our senior care. So for us, we need support from the federal government, either through the health transfers or some senior program, or maybe a pilot project for New Brunswick, where we get the support from the federal government to be innovative when it comes to healthcare and senior care when you have an aging population like we do.
Well, he better keep his wine glass full, I hope, at dinner. That might help move smoothly. Very quickly, Energy East, we had Brian Mulroney on this week. He said Energy East still has to be greenlit, in his view. You going to twist some arms on that one?
Well, every time I have a chance to sit with a minister of the federal government, I raise the Energy East pipeline. I say that we believe in New Brunswick it's a very significant economic opportunity for our province and for the country. And it's also a good project for the country in other ways. It's important for us to have a safe mode of transportation of oil to get it from the west to the east. We have rail carts, we have trucks, we have boats that have oil.
And you've got
in
Denis Coderre in Montreal.
there's your
obstruction.
Well, I think what's important for us is to have a conversation not based on personalities and not based on emotion, but a conversation based on the facts. And the facts are that we need a safe mode of transportation, which the Energy East pipeline would help us do, and we need to reduce our dependency on foreign oil in the east.
Okay.
And for us, having the Energy East pipeline come in, it will stimulate the economy and help us do those two things, all the while allowing the oil industry to diversify its market. So it's really a good project in many realms for the country.
All right. Premier Glenn, have fun tomorrow, and good luck. We'll see what happens. All right. So changing it slightly, we do have this conference that's going to confirm carbon pricing and penalizing in Canada, but a warning from down under. Australia had a carbon tax. Now it doesn't. To explain what happened, we're joined by Chris Berg. He's a senior fellow at Australia's Institute of Public Affairs, and he's here in the studio with me. Well, you had a tax. You don't have a tax. When was it imposed and why was it taken away?
Sure. So the bare bones of the story of this, it was introduced in 2012 and it was repealed in 2014. Now, that's a simple story, but it was one of the biggest debates in Australia's political history. We lost four political party leaders over this issue, five if you include the fact that Kevin Rudd lost his lost twice. Right. This was a big, big issue. And the reason that it was repealed was because it was seen to be very expensive. It affected people's living standards. It affected people's pocketbooks. But it didn't do what it said it would do. It didn't lead the world on climate change. So I've been travelling around Canada. I see the same arguments here. Canada's going to lead the world. Well, we tried to lead the world on climate change, and it turns out that the world didn't want to follow. So we repealed the tax.
Okay, but, you know, our premiers talk about, or our leaders, it's going to be revenue neutral. What we take in, we will rebate. That's how it's done in British Columbia, supposedly. So was that the case in Australia?
Absolutely. So we were told that this was a revenue neutral tax. Now, what do they mean by revenue neutral, of course? In our case, and I think in many Canadian cases, when they say revenue neutral, they just mean they're going to spend all the money they bring in. Well, so it's a tax then. So it's a tax that raises the tax burden on ordinary Australians that they're going to spend on all sorts of climate programs, all sorts of things like that.
Right.
Yeah, it was revenue neutral, but only from the government's perspective, not from the taxpayers.
Was it really a public backlash, or was it just sort of politics? Sometimes a party that opposes carbon taxation will just come in and say, oh, I'm taking that tax away, and the next party comes in, oh, I'm going to put it back. I mean, is that what it was, or was it a bona fide uprising from the grassroots?
Sure, I think there was a lot of things going on. Obviously, there's a lot of politics. There has to be politics. But by the end, 60% of people supported the repeal of the